Bumbcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Right, say you've got stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and you're tired of going back and forth to the oncology department, right, to the cancer center. You say, listen, I want to be at home with my soft blankets and my cat and my family, my grandbabies, and I'm done. I'm done having chemotherapy and radiation. When that thought starts coming up, I go in and visit with an individual like this, and this is what I explain to her will happen. We come in on day one and we do an assessment of her to determine one if she's appropriate. And obviously with a diagnosis like that, there's a very strong possibility this individual will pass away in the next 6 months. Doesn't mean she has to pass away in the next 6 months, but there's a good chance. I explain that she's going to have an RN case manager. So she'll have a nurse that will come in. That nurse comes in at a frequency based on her needs. So she's not there 24/7, but we're available 24/7 via our on-call service. So if this woman were to get into a pain crisis at 2 a.m, she could call our phone number and get an on-call nurse and get some help at 2:00 a.m.
Welcome to the Liberated Healer Podcast, where we touch on a variety of topics in the world of spirituality, energetic healing, and everything in between and beyond. Take an adventure on a shooting star with your hosts, Gina and Linnea, offering their wisdom, guidance, and everlasting love and support.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gina Cavalier, and this is the Liberated Healer Podcast, and we're coming today with Trace Bedwell. She is somebody who's been in the hospice care for a long time. I'm currently helping as a community relations person at Bozeman Lodge, and I met Trace, and we work a lot with them. They're one of our sister partners in hospice. We're talking about hospice today, and you know, I saw her come in and do a presentation, and I had no idea that hospice was not just this one thing that everybody thinks it is. And because I'm very interested in becoming a death doula or working at end of life healing, I'm very interested to talk to Trace today. Welcome on the podcast, Trace.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Gina.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this field?
Absolutely. When I graduated from college, my first job was doing what you're doing at the Bozeman Lodge. I was a marketing director for assisted living. And within about 6 months, I realized we had a population of people living there who really needed a lot of care. And assisted living in Montana was a social model. And these individuals living there, I felt like needed more care. At that time, a new hospice had opened in town, and they would come in and provide end-of-life care to people that were living in that assisted living, and a light bulb went off for me. I thought, aha, here is a loophole to get these people living in our community extra care when they're sick and frail and need care. And so after about 6 more months of working there, that hospice asked me to join them. I became an influencer in that assisted living, and I was making referrals to that hospice saying, you know, this resident might need your help or this resident might need help. And so they asked me to join them because they really recognized that I was an advocate for end of life care. So that was about 20 years ago. You grow up as a little girl having a lot of ideas on what you'll do for a living. And I never dreamed that I would spend my entire adult career in end of life care, but it was really the best decision I ever made joining that hospice. And throughout the two decades that I've done end of life care. I have started hospices. I've run them. I've sold them and I've grown them. And that's currently what I'm doing right now is working with Stillwater Hospice, growing their programs. We have them in Billings, Montana, Bozeman, Montana, Northern Wyoming, which is where I'm from. Super proud that we're down there. And then we have one in near Rapid City, South Dakota. And so this is my favorite job that I've had is growing them, because it allows me to do things like this, to get out to the community and really explain what hospice really is about, because there's so many misconceptions.
I agree. You know, getting out into really with the one-on-one in community, especially in something so scary and painful, and there's so many questions and mixed in with emotions, to be that everlasting guide that's very solid and straightforward and kind and informative, I think is actually very humbling, as anybody in this business has to be a humbled heart. What I found. And even at the senior communities, even if it's a paid senior community, you have to have a heart to even just get into that. So I didn't fully realize that, because I was mostly in the media business, but you know, what the first responders had to go through during COVID and how hard it really was to think about, these people were separated from their loved ones, literally couldn't even see them, and they were already kind of alone. So first of all, I want to say thank you for being a first responder and in this space and helping people. So everybody has that one vision of hospice, right? It's like you go, okay, so go ahead and tell us that that's not it. That's not all of it, right?
Right. I think a lot of times when I give a presentation, no matter where I'm at, an assisted living, a group of retired school teachers, just anywhere I go, I ask people, what's the first thing that comes to mind when I say hospice? I get a lot of a wide variety of answers. But one of the things that I hear over and over is, well, you have to die in 6 months, and they take all your meds away, and they bring in a hospital bed, and they put you on morphine. And it's such a sad picture. And the way they describe it sounds scary. And so it's just so refreshing to be able to share just with one person or 100 people that that's not what hospice looks like. Some people, they do want morphine right away. They want to stop all their meds. They want a hospital bed. But really what hospice does is we join people in the journey where they're at. We meet them where they're at. Some people don't want pain meds. Some people want to die in their own bed. And so we try to make it a beautiful experience based on what their needs are, not what our needs are. And so it's just really getting out there and dispelling those misconceptions about what people think hospice is. You know, one of the saddest things for me is when a celebrity goes on hospice. Not sad that they go on hospice, but when I hear the words, they gave up and they entered hospice. And that's such a misconception and such a disservice to our community and our society, because they're not giving up. They're just switching that focus from curative and, hey, we're going to fight this, that level of care, to, you know, that focus is switching. We have to switch the focus of the care, because maybe chemo, radiation, you know, those things aren't working anymore. And a lot of times with disease processes, as we age, we are not curing congestive heart failure or COPD. We are managing their symptoms. And so to say that people give up is sad for me, because it's not giving up. It's switching the focus to more comfort and palliative care.
Oh, I love that thought. I just got the chills, because, you know, every day that we have is such a blessing, you know, where we brought into this world with this beautiful, loving, I call it Dewey's like spiritual, like light inside of us. And we want to carry that as much as possible to the very end. And I like what you're saying, because instead of this being like, oh, it's over, you know, we're just going to hang out and see what happens. And why can't we have every single one of those days that within that, like recognition, that person knowing that they might be transitioning soon into, you know, a respectful, family filled love with comfort, experience, right? And going, when that time does come up, you know, going with without the covered in fear, is I think what I'm getting from you is that they immediately say, oh, they gave up. They go into fear. Yeah. Why do we don't have to go into fear. And I think that is maybe looking at the traditional, you know, Indian cultures and different older cultures. This was a rite of passage. This was a time where the tribe came around you and just, you know, put oils on you and flower essence and bathed you in water and respected you, and whatever happens, happens, right?
Right.
So, I love that you're kind of talking about that, because I'm kind of researching into going into being a death doula, and I don't know why that my spiritual path is taking me this way, but I want to help them ascend, or I want to help them kind of move out of that fear, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, thank you. Okay. So, so how does that usually pay for? I have no idea. Is that something covered by insurance, or how does that work?
That's a great question, Gina. So I know you have some listeners and some viewers outside of the United States, but the way it works here in the United States is it's covered by Medicare. If you are 65 and older, or you have Medicare disability, Medicare pays 100% of it. There is not a copay. There's not a deductible. People with that benefit incur zero costs. And in fact, some of the things that we pay for can take care of some out-of-pocket costs that they've already been spending for some of the supplies and things they need. Now, there are certain states that have Medicare, Montana being one of them. They pay exactly what Medicaid pays exactly what Medicare pays. So those individuals that may be under 65 and resource depleted, they qualify for Medicaid. And then people like you, maybe yourself or I, who have insurance through our employers, oftentimes they have a hospice benefit. So the rules are a little different for them, and we just call and find out what they pay for. But generally speaking, most insurances would much rather pay for hospice for end of life than having someone be in ICU for the last 25 days of their life, right? That's very, it's very expensive. And so it's a huge cost savings for our healthcare system to utilize hospice. And we're really good at working with insurance companies. You know, if they've got a home health benefit, you know, we will try to say, listen, can you switch that over to a hospice benefit? We can try to get them to see the cost savings. It's a huge, huge benefit for people. So a lot of times people think of hospice being nonprofits. And many, many years ago, 40 some years ago, when hospice was all volunteer work before Medicare decided to start reimbursing us for it, it was nonprofit, and they did fundraising, and it was all done without any resources. Wow. There are nonprofits in every town that has hospices. You'll find a nonprofit, and they do fundraising, but they are also reimbursed by Medicare. So we are all reimbursed by the government.
Oh my gosh, I got to give a little cheers to that, because you know you only hear negative stuff from the government mostly. Yeah. And that they came in and did that, because that's the one time that we should really kind of all come together and relieve that burden from people, right? So I don't even know this yet. So I'm learning as I go along with you, which is always exciting for me. But is it one nurse that comes in? Are they in 24 hours? Like, how do you determine what is the right amount of care? And do they kind of help guide the family, like what's happening? Or can you just explain a little bit of the care side of things?
Of course. This is what really gets me excited, because this is where people struggle with misconceptions. Sometimes people think we're there 24/7. I wish we could be. The government got this program right. I say it's one of the programs they got right, and I'm always praying they don't cut it. But they didn't give us enough money to do 24-hour care. So what a person can anticipate when they're thinking about end-of-life care, right? Say you've got stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and you're tired of going back and forth to the oncology department, right, to the cancer center. You say, listen, I want to be at home with my soft blankets and my cat and my family, my grandbabies, and I'm done. I'm done having chemotherapy and radiation. When that thought starts coming up, I go in and visit with an individual like this, and this is what I explain to her will happen. We come in on day one and we do an assessment of her to determine, one, if she's appropriate. And obviously with a diagnosis like that, there's a very strong possibility this individual will pass away in the next 6 months. Doesn't mean she has to pass away in the next 6 months, but there's a good chance. I explain that she's going to have an RN case manager. So she'll have a nurse that will come in. That nurse comes in at a frequency based on her needs. So she's not there 24/7, but we're available 24/7 via our on-call service. So if this woman were to get into a pain crisis at 2 a.m, she could call our phone number and get an on-call nurse and get some help at 2 a.m. So she has that RN case manager that can come 1 to 3 times a week. And at the end, that nurse will be there every day. Our nurses like to spend 45 minutes to an hour with people doing head-to-toe assessments and looking at their skin and their pain issues, their anxiety. How are you sleeping? Are your bowels moving? You know, there's a lot of moving parts. It's not just looking at that metastatic breast cancer. It's that total body care. So then they'll have a LPN, and an LPN can come in and do supplemental visits as well. So maybe 1 to 3 visits again during the week for 45 minutes to an hour. We have certified nursing assistants, home health aides. They come in and do all the things that you and I did today to get pretty, right? We did our hair, put lotion on, paint their nails, give them baths, shave them, change their sheets, you know, clean up their breakfast dishes, maybe make them breakfast. That's a really, really important part of the team. They help with all of the ADLs because as we reach end of life, you know, we become incontinent, we can't ambulate. And so having someone come in and make us smell good and look good and fresh sheets, it's life changing. Then we have social workers. And I always say, and my family is the craziest, if you have any dysfunction in your family, wait until someone nears end of life and there's money to fight over or a house or decisions about, does mom want to be cremated? Does she want to be buried? That social worker can help with those psychosocial issues that often arise. Even things like, you know, the cat. A lot of patients say, I can't die until I know my cat has a home. So over the last 20 years, you know, I've been approached by social workers. Do you want to take a horse? Do you want to take a cat? I need someone to take this dog. And so they have a tough job. Then we have chaplains. And chaplains, I say, are to meet people where they're at in their spiritual journey. It is not our job to bring someone to Jesus or whatever that chaplain's belief is. They're non-denominational. And oftentimes at end of life, if you haven't been a spiritual person, end of life can bring that out because then there's that thought of, wonder what's going to happen. Where are we going? What's out there? And so people become curious about that. There are other people who say, listen, I never want to talk about that. I'm atheist and I'm good. Let's just watch golf. I need someone to sit with me and hold my hand. I'm a little scared. The chaplain can do that as well. So that's what's called the interdisciplinary team. And I always like to reiterate, these people are not there 24/7. They're available 24/7. We are professional oversight and education. So what we're doing is you've got a patient in the home, in an assisted living, wherever they might live. Generally speaking, they have a loved one or a caregiver, and we're teaching them how to care for their loved one or their resident in their community. So teaching them how to administer morphine orally with a syringe, how to change a pain patch, how to roll them over, transfer them, change their depends. So we're professional oversight and education, teaching the caregiver how to take care of the patient. Now, sometimes people say, listen, I have no one in my life. My family's all gone. I've outlived all my friends. I'm not moving to an assisted living. I'm going to die on this ranch and I'm going to die without a caregiver. There are some hospices that would say, well, we can't take you because you don't have a caregiver. We take them. And the reason why is they're going to die with or without us. And it's better with us because the care that we can provide is better than nothing. And people will say, well, they're going to die alone. They're going to die alone without us. So if they die alone and they have no one, they may stay on their ranch for a long time before someone finds them. We will at least find them in a day or two. And so people have that right to die that way. They die like they live, and we allow people to do that. So in a nutshell, that's what the team comes in and does, right? The nursing, the psychosocial, the spiritual, the cares, all at no expense to the patient or family.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so it's like working together with a family or other assisted living places or wherever they are, just to put every ounce of energy and effort into making sure that person has exactly what they want and need. Yes. And then what happens when they kind of are reaching that end of care? Do you, obviously everybody's different, but do you still call 911 or a doctor, or you just kind of let, you give them more, you guys, you talk to them about, hey, when that starts to happen, you know, what do you want? You want more pain medicine, right? You talk about that beforehand, right?
Right. And when we bring someone on services, so on day one, when we meet, for example, this woman I'm talking about with metastatic breast cancer, and I explain the program and she says, oh my gosh, everything you just explained, that's what I need. That's going to allow me to stay home. My daughter's going to move in and be the caregiver. One of the things that I really try to hit home with her is we become your 911. You no longer have to go to the hospital. You no longer call 911. You call us, we come to you. And then that conversation starts immediately with our admission nurse about, what are your goals? What is most important to you? What do you want? And she might say, listen, I don't want to feel any pain. I don't really want to be conscious for this. I don't want to know what's going on. I want to have so much pain meds that I am free of pain, but also I don't know what's going on around me. That's her choice. She might also say, I want just enough pain meds to keep that pain at maybe a 4, but I want to know that my daughter's here and I want to be with my kitty and I want to watch The Young and the Restless. And so everybody's different, right? So it's our job to go in and find out, what are your goals? What do you want? What's most important to you?
So why do you guys go into assisted living and nursing homes, and how does that work?
Oh my gosh. This is where I get goosebumps. This is where I get so excited because I came from that world. Right. And I watched a caregiver run herself ragged. You know, we had 55 rooms, one caregiver. And after 6 months of this woman working here, she must've lost 80 pounds because she did not sit still. She was working hard. And I'm talking about people. And I think you probably see this too, Gina. We have sicker and sicker people moving into our communities, right? Years ago, those people might be in the hospital. They might be in a nursing home. Now they're kind of shifting to assisted living. And so they need a lot of help. They might need help bathing, dressing, grooming, toileting, you know, brushing their teeth, a lot of care. And this isn't all natural. This takes me an hour and a half to get this pretty. And so if you think about those ladies that live in these assisted living, they still want to be beautiful. Yeah. So if it takes an hour or even a half an hour for every woman in that facility for the caregiver to get ready, there's just not enough hours in the day, right? And so we all know that the pandemic created another crisis for all of us, a huge labor shortage. We knew that we were going to have a nursing shortage and a labor shortage, but COVID sped that up, right? Our poor frontline workers that had to wear masks 24/7, that were being tested for COVID, and just all of the things that were going on, a lot of healthcare providers left our field. And so now we're left with a smaller amount of people to help all these people in these assisted livings and nursing homes. So we become the loophole. Why do we go in? Medicare got this right. The government got this right. They said you can go into nursing homes, which are Medicare federally funded. And of course, you can go into assisted livings. They're private pay. That's a person's home. And you can be the frosting to that cake. I always say the nursing home, the assisted living, that's cake, right? It's so good. And we add the frosting to it. So what happens when we have maybe 10 people in Bozeman Lodge where you work? That means the CNA is going to come in there and provide 10 hours. That's just one visit a week per patient, per resident, 10 hours of care. So what if they came in twice a week, right? That's 20 hours of care. That is 20 hours that frees up the Bozeman Lodge CNAs or personal care attendants there to provide more care to the non-hospice residents. So hospice coming into buildings fixes a problem that we all know that we have, and that's a labor shortage. And so you think, well, why would we go in there? Well, where do people go to live out their last days? You know, if they're going to a nursing home, they're doing one of two things. They're getting rehab for a broken hip or a knee replacement, some sort of therapy, or they're going there to live out their last days. And the same for you. You know, the lodge is a great example of people going there, living there, and aging in place, and that's their last move. So statistically speaking, when you look at these buildings, conservatively, 10% of people in those buildings qualify for hospice. They're still walking around. They're still going to the dining room. They're still going to bingo. They're the little guy on 10 liters of oxygen that's, you know, having to stop every few feet because he can't breathe. He's got COPD so bad, and he's 90 years old.
Yeah.
We're looking at people like that, not just what we think of with that misconception of being on hospice and closing your eyes with your hands crossed on your chest in a hospital bed. Our hospice patients, we want to have more good days than bad. So they're in those buildings. And that's always been my biggest challenge, getting into those buildings, getting people to understand, hey, we're the frosting to your cake, man. We're extra hands. We're here to help. So I get pretty excited about that.
Well, I've learned a lot today from you. Because I'm obviously in there, and then I've, you know, gotten close to a lot of the residents, and you can see their health declining. And like, as you said, what COVID's still creeping back and forth, you know, and I think about what, you know, we are able to maybe, you know, take care of their needs, but sometimes they're a little lonely or bored or fearful. And especially if it's covered by mostly the, you know, covered, wouldn't they want to have an extra hand in there in this? So how do you determine if, like, some people say we would have in our building, maybe they're not quite, they don't know when they're going to, like, when you have cancer at that level that we're talking about is more of an obvious thing. So how do you determine when that person is just slowly kind of going that way? Is there any kind of assessment that you can think of that, you know, might be a good timing for you guys to come in? Like, are they not able to walk anymore or?
Absolutely. So there's kind of two buckets here that I look at. It's the bucket for the lay person. That's you and I, right? We're not nurses. We're not CNAs. We're not certified clinicians, but there's things we know to watch for, right? So if they're advanced age, 80 and older, they're having more falls, more infections, lots of UTIs. They're sleeping more, right? That's kind of a key indicator, sleeping more, weight loss, right? You don't have to weigh somebody to look at them and say, man, her clothes are fitting loose and she's losing weight. And it's often the caregivers that see that. Sleeping more, if they're eating 75% of their food, but they're still losing weight, that's a sign of decline. So in and out of the ER, right? Lots of hospital visits, something's going on. So that's kind of the bucket I look at for people who are not nurses, not nurse practitioners, not physicians, not mid-level providers. You and I can identify those people, right?
Yeah.
Then you identify that person, and then you go to the second bucket, right? And that's the more clinical side where Medicare put out some guidelines. So for example, if you've got a resident in your building who's having three or four of those things that I just talked about, right? He's sleeping more, he's falling, he's having UTIs, his oxygen's increasing, something's going on. We're seeing a decline. Then we have the nurse look at him and look at his history and physical. What's been going on? What percentage of his heart is functioning? So Medicare gives us guidelines that say, listen, if their heart is functioning at only 25%, that's a key indicator that hospice is probably appropriate. Protein, albumin levels, that will show if someone is wasting away, right? So it's called protein cal malnutrition. No matter how much they eat, their body is not absorbing that nutrition and they're losing weight. So we can do blood draws on that. So that second bucket digs deeper, right? It really looks at the guidelines and says, geez, based on these numbers and these lab results, we would not be surprised if this person passed away in the next 6 months. But here's the great thing about hospice. You do not have to pass away in 6 months. That is a guideline. That is something that we're shooting for, right? But thank goodness we don't have a crystal ball. If I knew the exact date of my death, there's probably not enough Ativan to keep me going because I'd be so anxious, right? But we can make educated guesses, right? Age, the things I talked about in the first bucket, this little decline, that's these declines that are going on. Then based on labs and this decline that's been going on, we're making an educated guess that this person may pass away in the next 6 months. But the great thing that Medicare did is they set up guidelines that allow for people to have two 90-day benefit periods with an unlimited number of 60-day benefit periods as long as this person declines, right? So you're on 6 months and you're still alive. That's okay as long as you're declining. And we send a doctor out every cert period, every other cert period to look at them to make sure they're still appropriate as long as they're having decline. And I'm not talking huge decline, like you have to have another cancer diagnosis. I'm talking about maybe 2 or 3 UTIs, 5-pound weight loss, sleeping more, you know, eating less. There are key indicators of decline that don't have to be huge that allow for someone to continue staying on hospice. So that's another thing that in part of this benefit, it's not that black and white. It's got to be 6 months. There's a lot of wiggle room. So I always say people can sometimes be on hospice hours, days, weeks, months, even years. Now those years are outliers, but they have happened because the next step for this person, you know, if they've been on for 18 months, the next step of decline is them passing away. And how unfair would that be for us to discharge them when their next step is death? They need us.
Wow. This is, you know, yeah, you've just completely dispelled hospice in a way. And I'm so grateful because, again, as soon as you hear that word, unless you know what you just described, you immediately go into, you know, that's it. You know, it's a couple weeks left and things like that. And I did not know who pays for it. And so I was wondering, how could they pay for, say, they want to be in an assisted living place and you were going to pass away there. How do they pay for a private situation and a hospice? You know, that dispels that. And, you know, the whole reason why I created this channel was to provide well-being information in mind, body, and spirit, because I want to completely, constantly be putting out there the positive energy. And a lot of my focus starts with children, animals, and the elders, because yes, the three most vulnerable communities that need to have a voice, and we need to. Just being a part of working with the seniors and this other, no matter how long I do it, has been extremely rewarding in my spiritual path, because I asked my own spirit, why did I get this journey with this position at Bozeman Lodge, other than, you know, I have my really good friend it owns it. But it was, I needed to make sure that I never left the elders out of my conversations. And even though in my heart, it was in my heart, but I need to get it out there a little bit more, because they are, to me, the foundation of why a lot of this stuff is bubbling up to the surface, because we have left our tribal knowledge behind. We have not given them the amount of respect that they absolutely deserve. This needs to be something that is in every single, we should not have a single person die alone that doesn't want to die alone. We do a single person that is ill or from a disease and you know, suffering, and they're alone. Never. And that will as our community starts to work a little bit more to shed that love, then we'll just see all the boats rise, you know, and the children get to see how much respect their grandparents went out with. And when they get older, they'll carry that on. So we just have to constantly be doing the work that you and I are doing. And again, I want to thank you so much for today and all the information you gave us. And I am really just surprised that is that what there is that much information for us to go through today. So here's to you, Trace, and your team and what you're doing. And thank you for your time today. And this is Gina Cavalier with The Liberated Healer. And we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks, Trace Bedwell and Stillwater Hospice.
Thanks, Gina. I really appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can find us online at theliberatedhealer.com, on Instagram at Liberated Healer Podcast, or on Facebook at The Liberated Healer. Give us a follow, subscribe, send us a message if you so feel, and thank you for your support.
Pumpcast.